This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony. Arnold Schoenberg is one of the most famous and at the same time notorious names in the history of music. In any discussion about the so-called demise of classical music in the 20th century, Schoenberg's name will invariably be one of the first to come up. But Schoenberg never thought of himself or his 12-tone system as revolutionary. To him, it was evolutionary. And he also famously once said, "There is still plenty of good music to be written in the key of C." So it is perhaps not so strange that it would be Schoenberg who would orchestrate one of the greatest chamber works by that 19th century classicist who also saw himself as evolutionary, Johannes Brahms. In 1939, as he was preparing to write about Schoenberg's orchestration of Brahms' piano quartet, the San Francisco Symphony's program annotator, Alfred Frankenstein, inquired if Schoenberg would comment about the piece himself. Schoenberg, who was then teaching at UCLA, replied that he had three reasons for making the orchestration. 1, I like this piece. 2, it is seldom played. 3, it is always very badly played, because the better the pianist, the louder he plays, and you hear nothing from the strings. I wanted once to hear everything, and this I achieved. End quote. In listing his goals, Schoenberg offered these words. 1, to remain strictly in the style of Brahms, and not to go farther than he himself would have gone if he lived today. 2, to watch carefully all these laws which Brahms obeyed, and not to violate such, which are known only to musicians educated in his environment. And finally, in explaining his technique, Schoenberg said that he had long been acquainted with Brahms's style and his principles. He had analyzed many of Brahms's works, and had played this piece many times as both violist and cellist. I therefore know how it should sound, he said. I had only to transpose this sound to the orchestra, and this is, in fact, what I did. End quote. Now, the naive way to orchestrate a piece like this would be to give as much as possible of Brahms' string parts to the orchestral strings and let the woodwinds and brass take care of the piano material. That would be an accurate translation of a sort, but it's the sort that gives accuracy a bad name. It certainly would not sound like a convincing orchestra piece. The translator or transcriber would need to take on the double task of producing a score that faithfully conveys the expressive and structural sense of the original and that sounds like a convincing composition in its own right. This was the challenge that Schoenberg felt he had met. In his letter to Frankenstein, Schoenberg also wrote that, I wanted for once to hear everything, and this I achieved. That he did, and this is one reason Schoenberg's orchestration has been so controversial among traditionalists. Everything is audible and on equal footing. Not so strange, coming from the man who invented a system in which all notes are equal. But in achieving this remarkable balance, Schoenberg sacrificed the hierarchies in Brahms's scoring, along with much of the vividness and clarity. In a subtle way, Schoenberg's orchestration, for all its honorable intentions, spills from translation into transformation. Schoenberg knew his Brahms, but he was modest in contending that he knew how the quartet should sound and had only to transpose this sound to the orchestra. Here, Schoenberg's imagination, his analytical acumen, his creative exuberance, and his enormous experience as an orchestrator come into play. Not everyone would know that the piano's octaves in the first three measures should have the sound of E-flat clarinet, B-flat clarinet, and bass clarinet in octaves. But when he said he intended to remain strictly in the style of Brahms and not to go further than he himself would have gone if he lived today, Schoenberg contradicts himself in measure one. Two of those clarinets are instruments you will find in none of Brahms' own scores. But he redeems himself in this passage, a virtual mirror to an identical passage in Brahms' Symphony No. 4. The development section of the first movement is a prime example of Schoenberg's imagination as a translator, all the more interesting for seeming to stay within Brahms's style. This first movement has always been a target for critics. Too many themes, themes insufficiently distinguished, the recapitulation unconvincingly prepared and entered. What a surprise! Brahms did not follow the rules. But the symphonic sound scale of Schoenberg's orchestration makes Brahms's achievements here in this movement all the more convincing. Instead of a scherzo, the second movement is an intermezzo in a tempo that's neither slow nor fast. This is characteristic of Brahms, especially in his chamber music and even his symphonies. Typically, the central section is quicker. Schoenberg's scoring is rich but light, and it pushes the limits of Brahmsness in the trio. The final ping on the triangle suggests the Nutcracker. And in fact, Schoenberg once confided that there was nothing he longed for more intensely than to be taken for a better sort of Tchaikovsky. End quote. The third movement begins as a lush, lyrical andante. The original is full of piano figures that might not easily translate to a full orchestra, but Schoenberg's imaginative scoring makes it work. The middle section of the movement becomes a swashbuckling, quasi-military march. If you think of this section as Brahms offering a chamber transcription of some imaginary band music, then Schoenberg's task is to retrieve the imagined original, while at the same time elevating it from band music to the splendors of a grand orchestral style. Once again, he makes it work. With each movement, Schoenberg expands on his concept and lets his imagination run more freely. The finale is Alla Zingarese, in the gypsy style. Once again, Schoenberg challenged himself to make explicit what Brahms could only allude to in a chamber setting, adding special effect on top of special effect with xylophone, tambourine, flutter tongue on stopped horn, glissandos for muted trombones. And his own gypsy touches. There are more echoes of Brahms's Fourth Symphony. In fact, Schoenberg would sometimes refer to this work as Brahms' Symphony No. 5. One of Schoenberg's most daunting challenges was how to handle the solo piano cadenza. Again, he opens up the soundscape, starting off with a wailing plunge of the E-flat clarinet, as the piano's left-hand stabs become a dazzling mixture of plucked solo strings, trilling woodwinds, and snapping brass. all culminating in the tumultuous fortissimo descent of all the cellos and basses. After a brief interlude, the gypsies return, quietly at first, with solo violin. Joined by a quartet. Then the full orchestra. Joining in for a rousing finale with almost everything but the kitchen sink. When Schoenberg wrote, "I like this piece," he meant more than just his fondness for Brahms' piano quartet in G minor. By styling himself as an evolutionary composer, Schoenberg was trying to protect his place in the tradition, by which he meant primarily the central Austro-German tradition, from Bach through Mahler and Richard Strauss to him. He actually wrote an essay in 1950 titled Brahms the Progressive, in which he tried to make the case that his work was the next logical step from Brahms in the progression of absolute music. By putting his own stamp on Brahms's quartet, Schoenberg hoped that listeners would not only participate in and rediscover this piece, but they would see the connections for themselves. Brahms had once autographed a fan for Johann Strauss's stepdaughter, writing down the first few bars of the Blue Danube with the words, "Unfortunately not by Johannes Brahms." Schoenberg, perhaps just doodling, but perhaps not, once wrote Brahms's inscription on a piece of paper, and then underneath he added the first four bars of the G minor quartet with the notation, "Unfortunately by Johannes Brahms, only orchestrated by Arnold Schoenberg." This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony.